Chapter 17, All Alone. Everyone at Twistyard congratulated Green Hall for their unusual victory over Rawl Hall. That is, everyone except Sob and his team of losers. It was the only thing people were talking about for days. Dodd did his best to share the glory with all of his teammates. After all, he hadn't even thrown a single globe. But overwhelmingly, fans saw Dodd's deflection moves and strategic tackle as sheer genius. The next week was relatively uneventful. Dilly did her best to line up an engagement with Yuke, though the meeting kept getting bumped by urgent business relating to preparations for Bamboo's next trip. Tritacello had returned to Twistyard and was insisting Bamboo accompany him on a brief journey to Sush. Sonny spent a lot of her time in the library, consulting with Ascertaini and reading books. Specifically, she studied a myriad of things about the Dread and did some research on plants Dr. Shelderhick had mentioned. Boot and Buck were so energized by their Belurse victory that they hardly found time to talk about anything else. And in their wave of interest in the game, the brothers spent their days off at the field holding practice matches and training. Kindly, however, they didn't insist everyone show similar attention to the sport. Dilly and Dodd spent their time differently. They puttered around, casually continuing to investigate things on Dilly's big list. During their lull time one afternoon, Dilly suggested they practice swordplay, since Sir Long's injury and vacation had completely ended her opportunity for staying sharp. Boot's room was the perfect spot for exercising, because there was plenty of space and privacy, given most of Green Hall was ensnared in the Belurse binge led by Boot and Buck. The offer was enticing to Dodd. He really did want to learn, yet the thought of swishing swords with Dilly was concerning. He had hardly held a sword, let alone become anywhere near proficient enough to duel. "How about I watch you practice?" responded Dodd, doing his best to hide his ambivalence. "Watch," said Dilly in surprise. She furrowed her brows for a few moments until her face melted into a look of recognition. "Oh, I see," she said confidently. "You don't want to swing Pap's sword around. I guess I didn't make myself clear enough. You don't need to worry. I have spar swords in my collection. You know, they're dull and they retract into the hilt when you strike. There's no chance of you accidentally hurting me. They're quite nifty creations. Bly is definitely on my list of favorite inventors." "And I assume you think I'm pretty good with the sword," stammered Dodd sheepishly. "Obviously," said Dilly. "You've battled for real." "But I must warn you, I've practiced a lot. I've even originated a few moves of my own. Not for competition, for last resort against a rogue like the Dread. Who knows? Maybe I could teach you a thing or two." "I'm sure you could teach me more than you think," divulged Dodd, groaning dejectedly. "It's embarrassing." Dilly studied Dodd's face and could tell he was uncomfortable. He was hiding something he didn't care to discuss. Her eyes showed concern as she treaded carefully. "Are you still recovering from your accident?" she asked. "Sort of," said Dodd, stealing a glance at her before looking away. Since the event, he paused for a moment, then decided there was no need to clarify everything about his unusual circumstance. "Well, anyway, after the accident and everything, some things are clear and other things fade in and out. It's hard to explain. I'm not always able to competently do what people say I've done in the past." "Oh," said Dilly, looking sympathetic. "You've got some memory loss." "I guess," admitted Dodd hesitantly. "Don't be ashamed," snapped Dilly. "It's not your fault." Dodd felt guilty in describing his circumstance as partial amnesia, but that seemed more believable than suggesting he was from an entirely different realm. Not to mention, Dodd still didn't understand where the memories came from and why he knew so much about some things and so little about others. In truth, it did feel like he was gradually regaining his memory, one flash at a time. "You heard what happened to Bowie, didn't you?" "Only bits and pieces," responded Dodd. "He had a hard time remembering things, too, after his accident. He was seriously injured during a sword fight while accompanying Pap. Something happened and Bowie ended up underneath a pile of logs. He spent some time in the hospital, unconscious, and when he returned to Twistyard, his broken arm recovered faster than his memory." "Oh," sighed Dodd. "If everyone would have been a little bit nicer to him, I'm sure he'd have stayed. Some things just take time. If you can't remember how to do something, pretend you haven't done it before, and then with practice, you'll likely find it will come back to you." "Do you think so?" asked Dodd. "I'm sure of it," said Dilly, smiling. "Just look at how well you've fooled us so far. I wouldn't have guessed you had any memory loss if it weren't for a few strange comments. You know, like when we were entering Highgate, you acted as though you were seeing it fresh." "You're right," admitted Dodd. When I saw Highgate, it was like I was seeing it for the first time. It took a few minutes for the memories to follow. Dilly swung a large bag off her shoulder and clanked it on the bedroom floor. She bent down and began to pick up the loose shirts and socks that Boot had left around his room and heaped them on Boot's bed. "Let me guess," she said. "You're nervous about dueling."
"Terrified," confessed Dodd. "Would you teach me?"
"Sure, I'll give you a refresher course, but you have to promise that you'll keep practicing with me later, even when it all comes back to you." Dodd nodded his head and agreed to the terms. The situation was perfect. It had been bothering him that despite bursts of inspiration, he lacked real battle skills like swordplay, which would eventually matter when facing the Dread, or a Venus, or any other enemy. With the deal struck, lessons began and they continued every day thereafter. Unfortunately, advanced swashbuckling wasn't exactly a skill that could be acquired overnight. Dilly quickly assessed that Dodd truly didn't remember how to fence, so she taught him a reassuring move she had invented herself. It was called Disaster. In the event that Dodd needed to fight for his life, Disaster was ideal. It was a clever trick where one fakes a backward stumble while lunging forward with a sword. When done properly, it deceived the eyes just enough to catch an enemy off guard. Dilly calmed Dodd's feelings of inadequacy by insisting that if he only mastered Disaster, it alone could save his life in the event of an attack, so he didn't need to worry about how slowly he was remembering swordplay. After a week, when Sir Lonk and Juni finally returned, Dodd was one of the first people to welcome them back. He had promised Boot that he would join the others in a practice game of Belurse that afternoon, as soon as he finished his Hatu lesson from Tinja, similar to karate. Dilly had specially arranged for Tinja to help Dodd regularly in an attempt to bring it back, which Dodd didn't refuse. On his way to the field, Dodd approached Sir Lonk and Juni, who were dismounting in the barn. "How was your trip?" hollered Dodd happily. He was feeling pretty good and enjoying the perfect weather. Sir Lonk looked over and raised one eyebrow, just enough to acknowledge that he had heard Dodd's welcome, but went right on busily doing something. As Dodd entered the barn, planning on cutting straight through to the Belurse field, he realized Sir Lonk was verbally lashing someone who was standing on the other side of his horse.
"I should have known something like this would happen," chided Sir Lonk. "You're incompetent. That's the problem. You're all incompetent."
As Dodd passed, he didn't stop or get involved, and he even avoided looking at them due to the embarrassing nature of the conversation. However, he was curious to find out who Sir Lonk was scolding. "We did everything in our power to keep things safe, I assure you," said a voice that clearly revealed the mystery man behind the horse to be Jib. He was cut short when Sir Lonk continued chastening him.
"There's no excuse, none, and I don't doubt you've had your grubby hands all over my things, taking advantage of your troops' careless efforts to secure Twistyard with any basic standard of safety. It's really amazing I'm foolish enough to keep returning here. We're crazy, aren't we, Juni? Crazy."
"I can assure you," said Jib in a controlled, polite voice, "nobody has stepped foot in your quarters since my guards discovered the door had been breached, for we all know how dearly you cherish your privacy. But now that you're back under your watchful eye, we would be happy to do a thorough walkthrough investigation, if it would please you."
"You? Investigate? That's preposterous! Why, that's the most absurd thing I've heard all week, and after Juni's aunt offered me advice on swordplay, I thought I had heard it all."
"Please, accept my personal apology for our momentary lapse in security, and know that we are currently working on apprehending whoever is ultimately responsible for this crime. When you have assessed the damage or loss, please inform us. I'm sure it will help our investigation."
"I'll make it known, you can count on that, though it won't be to the likes of you, drat. I'm going straight to Bamboo. This incident proves what I've been saying for years now. He's out of touch and too old to see what's going on around him."
Dodd continued on his way to the field, so eventually Sir Lonk's angry voice faded into the distance. Yet overhearing the dispute raised a question. Was Jib lying? And if not now, what about before in the hall? Regardless, the blurred truth didn't stop Dodd's impression of Jib from improving based on the situation. He was surprised to see how dignified Jib acted in handling such a precarious conversation, which would have sent a lesser leader hiding from Sir Lonk in anticipation of the confrontation rather than awaiting his return in the barn. After Belurse practice, Dilly announced at dinner that Yuke was tentatively planning on a casual chat that evening in his quarters. She beamed with satisfaction, having persisted long enough to accomplish her goal. Sonny gave her a skeptical look. "You really think he'll make time for us tonight?" she asked.
He said he would, and I actually believe him, replied Dilly with confidence. Bamboo just left with Tritacello, Zerny, and Jib a few minutes ago, so whatever preparations Yuke's been up to for Bamboo must be done. Is Bamboo going to Highgate tonight? Questioned Dodd. He wondered how Bamboo would get past the Triblot Field. No, he's first visiting some friends that live in Highgate's border town, said Dilly. He'll go on to Sush tomorrow. The conversation turned to discreetly planning the evening's efforts to recover Pap's keys when it was suddenly shut down by the unexpected approach of Sirlonk and Juni. Both of them looked aggravated. Dilly, thundered Sirlonk, where's your great-grandfather convalescing? Surely he's hiding in some corner of this palace, trying feebly to gain strength enough to address the regular downpour of incompetence. I have urgent business with him. Where shall I find him? The tips of Dilly's ears and the high of her cheeks began to tinge red hot. Nobody spoke ill of Bamboo without facing her wrath, not even hostile aristocrats. You've just missed him, said Buck, jumping to his feet. Come this way and hurry. We might catch him if we run. Buck led the miserable twosome from the Great Hall while explaining that Bamboo was on his way out of town to do important business. Dodd, Boot, and Sonny all watched Buck disappear into the front field, but Dilly was busy looking down at the floor and counting to 100 million in an attempt to control her venomous outbursts. Within a few minutes, Buck came jogging back. He looked very pleased with himself. I sent them down to the lakeshore, said that Zerny was going with him. And since Bamboo wasn't in the barn, he might have gone to Zerny's before departing. I think the walk will do them some good. They'll need to walk farther than the shore to do me any good, snapped Dilly. She was still mad, yet appeared grateful Buck had helped her avoid getting sour with them. Oh, and I asked Sirlonk about his visit with Duchy, added Buck. He said the boy is in poor health and didn't want to make an issue with everyone here, so he simply slipped out at night. Sirlonk also said that if we're lucky, and the boy fully recovers, he might be coming back in a year or two. That doesn't sound like Sirlonk, jabbed Boot with a smirk. Are you sure we're talking about the same Sirlonk? After someone from Rawl has fallen, I can't imagine that they would ever be received back. Sonny noticed the time and prodded everyone to get moving. She wanted them to be punctual for their meeting with Yuke, and knew that the flights of stairs would be brutal. Dodd, Boot, and Buck ran to their room for gear, and then met up with Sonny and Dilly in the resting hall by Yuke's quarters. They were all out of breath, but just in time. Within seconds of arriving, Yuke came floating around the corner with his big feathered hat waving as he chuckled to himself. You're here, he said. Oh, ha, ha, I'm sorry. I was just remembering something terribly funny. Unfortunately, I think it is only funny to me. Come on in, don't let the crazy man scare you. There was something noticeably strange about Yuke. He was erratically cheery, enough that it felt fake to Dodd and the others. There was also something hidden behind his eyes. Regardless, the group entered his quarters and began small talk, acting as if everything was perfectly normal. I like what you've done to your front hall, fibbed Dilly, noticing Yuke had taken down his wall of paintings and replaced them with bizarre antiques. Are those tools or weapons? Some of both, my dear, some of both, said Yuke pleasantly. He stepped closer to the collection and smiled. There's no telling what these relics were used for. The bloodstains seem to indicate a violent purpose, though, don't they? Dodd felt a chill as Yuke turned his way, his smile shifting to more of a grimace. I like them, Yuke continued. My favorite is this one. He pointed at an old wooden rod with 6 rusted blades protruding out of the top. It was hanging at about eye level, surrounded by other objects of curious origins. I don't have any swords around, Yuke confessed frankly. You know, Bamboo's current policy. He then plucked his favorite weapon from the wall and pointed it directly at Dodd, adding sternly, So I decided to freshen up my entry with useful art. Intruders may find my interest in historic particulars, especially the use of this Zarek dangerously cold. Classy, blurted Buck, watching Yuke flash the Zarek around in the air before putting it back. Buck and Sonny sighed with relief, grateful they had decided to enter as invited guests. Dilly drooled jealously at Yuke's battle skills. Boot gazed toward the patio door, obviously plotting his next step, hardly aware of the show. And Dodd cringed with concern, not terribly happy to have had the demonstration aimed at him, and wondering whether Yuke was still sore about the brown sugar incident. Please, come in and take a seat, insisted Yuke, gesturing with his arm toward an elegantly decorated greeting room. Your company as friends is welcomed in this lonely place. With Salusi around, it couldn't possibly be lonely, said Dilly, bubbling with charm. She loves entertaining, doesn't she? Well, said Uke, drawling despondently. His cheerfulness dimmed as he looked around the room, inspecting the emptiness of his quarters. He walked over and plopped himself down brutishly into a feather-stuffed chair, uncharacteristic of his usual refined ways, and then continued on with the conversation. Lately, he admitted slowly, she's been too busy to come here, and the kids are helping her. She's gone up the coast for a while, charity work. Oh, said Dilly, feeling sorry for Uke. Now that you mention it, I haven't seen her for a couple of weeks. What city are they staying in? Terraboom? Dilly casually sat down in a reed chair that had an obnoxiously straight back. The piece of furniture looked great for being in a museum, with its golden tassels, embroidered purple velvet backing, and delicately carved trim, but it didn't look comfortable like Uke's. I can't say, replied Uke calmly. You know how it is with her. Even if she told me where she was going, I wouldn't feel confident that she would stay there for long. Something always comes up, and she's off like the startled tips of a roseweed. After that, the room went quiet for a few horrible minutes. Sonny took the matching seat next to Dilly, while Dodd, Boot, and Buck situated themselves on the floor at the girl's feet, not wanting to take either of the remaining chairs that were on the opposite side of the room, snuggled tightly against Uke's. Mentioning Seleucia had turned the atmosphere from that of a carnival spectacle, with Uke proudly at the head of ceremonies, into a deserted ghost town, lacking so much as a warm body to stir the dust. Sonny's squeaky chair was the only audible sound once the boys were situated. It made Sonny blush until she elbowed Dilly in the ribs. That reminds me, said Dilly, attempting to revive the deceased conversation. I met Seleucia's uncle Nedro the other day. Solank was introducing me to a few visiting dignitaries, and he was one of them. He's quite ambitious, isn't he? Yes, Nedro. Ah ha ha ha. Nedro's a one-of-a-kind chump. Mentioning Nedro perked Uke back up and sent him rolling forward, like he was unfolding a classroom discourse, without needing any further interjections. Nedro had fought in various battles over the years, and Uke, as a master of strategy, knew the particulars of every one, not to mention he had planned more than half of them. The evening flew by with plenty of laughing and joking, never dipping back into the bucket of melancholy they had seen Uke momentarily wallow in. But despite repeated attempts to persuade Uke to do otherwise, he cautiously refused to leave his post at the side of his guests. At one point, Dilly made a comment that seemed to indicate she was hungry, hoping Uke would be a proper host and head to his kitchen for a snack. However, he happened to have a full bag of strups, similar to dried apples, and a box of Chew Yummy in his parlor cabinet, so while continuing another war story, he produced a perfect refreshment. Dodd sat on the floor between Boot and Buck, fidgeting occasionally to stop the tingling in his behind. 1 hour of stories was nice. Nevertheless, by the time the sun had set, some three later, it was uncomfortable to sit any longer. It sounds like you've seen it all, said Dodd, interrupting Uke in the middle of another delightful tale. Dodd rose to his feet and rocked back and forth, endeavoring to get the blood flowing enough to stop the throbbing. I think part of me has already fallen asleep, said Dodd, and then noticing Uke's face, quickly sputtered, not because of your stories, they're wonderful. I just have, a problem with my legs. Dilly could see that something had to be done if they hoped to accomplish their mission, so she faked a coughing attack and asked for a drink. Unfortunately, like her other attempts, it didn't work. Rather than head out of the room, Uke offered a logical solution, making it difficult to persuade him otherwise without appearing suspicious. I'm afraid to say I don't have anything special, said Uke, apologetically. With Seleucia gone, it's pointless to stock up when I can eat downstairs. Three meals are plenty. Perhaps we could go to the grand kitchen together and find some juice. I'm sure Mercy wouldn't mind. Shall we go? That sounds great, interjected Sonny, who jumped to her feet. Dilly gave Sonny a what-are-you-doing look the moment Uke turned his head to walk toward the door, but Sonny responded with her own please-trust-me look. Oh, Uke, said Sonny inquisitively, raising her eyebrows, is this the leaf of a Burris calpus plant? She bent down and picked up a dried brown leaf from off the floor in the corner of the room. I just got done reading a book written by Dr. Schelderhig, where he claims they don't do well as houseplants in green. Do you happen to have one? Yes, as a matter of fact, I do, said Uke, straightening his back. And it's thriving very nicely, thank you. May I see it before we go? Asked Sonny, blinking her eyes innocently and pouring on a heavy dose of charm. It would be wonderful to have something to dispute with Dr. Schelderhig next time I visit Highgate. I suppose you can have a quick look, said Uke hesitantly. Concern crossed his face, but he still led Sonny into the rear of his apartment. The moment he disappeared, Boot, Buck, and Dodd hurried out the back door and onto his patio, while Dilly moved to the front door and opened it up, making a clanking and stomping sound with her feet. "Are you all right?" asked Duke, surprising Dilly with how suddenly he reappeared. He had left Sonny still admiring his plant in the kitchen. "I'm fine. It's just my feet. They've drifted off like Dodd's. I was attempting to get them back by stomping." "Sure, that chair slows the blood to your legs, doesn't it?" responded Uke. "Sonny, are you about done in there? It appears the boys are anxious for their juice. Shall we be at it?" Sonny took her time and eventually came plodding down the hall, studying a sample she had taken. "You have a fascinating specimen," she said excitedly, appearing to be very interested. "It's the best I've ever seen, inside or out. How do you get it to thrive in your kitchen?" "I cheat," said Uke frankly, and then he laughed manically. "Let me show you my back patio. It's the secret to my success with plants." Uke moved toward the door through which the boys had just exited as he continued explaining his technique. "I rotate them out there and only bring them in occasionally. If you were to know the truth, Sonny, I don't actually do very well at keeping a traditional houseplant. They all seem to die on me." Sonny peered out the hall window as she passed by and noticed the boys were clearly visible, moving around in the darkness. "I'll take you up on the offer another time if you don't mind," insisted Sonny nervously, shuffling her way to the back door before Uke. "It's too dark for me to enjoy your garden right now." "And we need a hurry," added Dilly from the entry hall. "I think the boys have already left us." She poked her head out the front door and pretended to be surprised that she couldn't see them. "Very well, let's go," said Uke abruptly, spinning around. He tapped his hat three times with a fancy stick that he had plucked from a large vase near his coat closet and then pointed the way for Sonny. Meanwhile, Dodd, Boot, and Buck were busy on the dark patio, assessing what part of the stone wall to climb. It was more of a challenge than they had imagined. In the blackness of the moonless night, stars glimmered from between clouds with just enough light to see the wall, but not enough to judge its height. Boot pulled the pulsar flex from his waist pouch and threw it high in the air, with the very end of the rope wrapped around his left hand. The red balls did their task and clung tightly to the stone surface, 25 feet up. Regrettably, the full length of the rope was clearly a distance short of the top. "If we climb up, how will we make it the rest of the way?" complained Buck. "It's a dead end." As Dodd gazed at the rope leading to the middle of the wall, an idea entered his mind. He could imagine someone scaling a cliff with a pulsar flex. Each time the person got to the top of the rope, he took two short knives and jammed them in cracks, then rested his weight on the knives while repositioning the pulsar flex. It was daring, but brilliant. "I'll do it," said Dodd. He volunteered before his nerves had time to convince him otherwise. "Are you sure?" asked Boot tentatively. "It looks to me like we should abandon this plan. When Bamboo gets back, let's come clean with him about the whole problem. He could have men remove the solid door downstairs in a flippy. You'd get entrance to Pap's place, and at that point you could search for Pap's keys without risking your life." "No," responded Dodd. "Bamboo wouldn't be able to trust me anymore. Besides, if Bamboo had men break the door down, it would create enough of a stir that I doubt it would stay a secret. And there's no telling who's a friend and who's not. I've got to do this." There was a basket of gardening tools that lay on the ground by Buck's feet. Dodd bent down and started rummaging, assessing its contents by what he felt. "Perfect. These are perfect," sighed Dodd apprehensively. He held up two weed prodders that resembled sturdy screwdrivers, though no one could see them very well. "Wish me luck," he said, taking a deep, drawn-out breath. His heart was racing. "You really don't have to do this," whined Buck. "Besides, if you fall and get hurt, we'll all be in trouble. Eyeball deep." "Come on," said Dodd, wishing he could muster a sterner voice, but lacking anything louder than a groveling whisper. "Help me by holding the line tight." He tucked the tools in his back pocket and began to scale the wall. The rope jerked and swayed until Boot stepped in and anchored it pole stiff. "You're one crazy coosing," muttered Boot, both excited and nervous for Dodd. "Not as crazy as the two of you," said Dodd, feeling more confident as he made his way up the rope. "I just don't want to be caught in Uke's place. He'd use that Zarek thing on me." "Oh, tick blood," moaned Buck in agony, realizing they had to exit through Uke's quarters. He hoped the patio door wasn't locked, and that Uke would take a long, long time fetching juice. Grasping the rope with both hands brought back childhood memories for Dodd. In second grade, Cole's teacher had insisted everyone in her class attempt climbing a rope that was connected to the ceiling of the gymnasium. A few boys and one girl had made it to the top. All of the kids had climbed at least a few feet off the floor, except Cole. His hands hadn't been able to grasp the rope tight enough to pull his body up. The mean boys had been ruthless about it, teasing him mercilessly. However, that wasn't where the memory ended. For the next year, every day, Cole had squeezed two palm-sized balls Pap had given him. They strengthened his hands and forearms until he had been able to climb a practice rope, hung in a willow by the stream near his house. In fourth grade, the next time everyone had been required to climb the gym rope, Cole had insisted he go first, and had set the fastest time. It was empowering to remember. So, with years of practice behind him, Dodd felt at home gliding up the PulsarFlex line. It was something he did well, and within a few short seconds he reached the balls at the top. Nevertheless, that was the easy part. Next, he searched the rock face around him with his fingers for any cracks, while his feet and knees held the rope. It was a circus-like act to perform. He prodded each tiny rift with Uke's gardening tools until two holes in the mortar were discovered. In one, he placed a tool to stand on, and in the other, a tool to hold. Once the instruments were inserted firmly, they were precarious but secure. Finally, perched on one foot, holding the upper tool with the bend of his left arm, Dodd did the unthinkable. He jiggled the PulsarFlex until the balls let go of the wall. Down below, Boot and Buck strained their eyes as they watched silently, hoping Dodd would be all right, but powerless to do much of anything if he weren't. "Just throw the rope and climb it," muttered Dodd to himself as he coiled the line. He was terrified stiff, balancing on a painfully small roost, mumbling to ease his nerves. "Throw it, climb it. It's just that simple," whispered Dodd. "I can do this." Ho-whoosh! Dodd gave the PulsarFlex an upward toss. However, it wasn't hard enough. Much of the rope remained in a clump, preventing the balls from sticking to the wall. Ho-whoosh! Another failed attempt. Ho-whoosh! And another. It was awkward for Dodd to get the line in position without compromising his stability. Each unsuccessful try was followed by a methodical recoiling of the rope and stretching of his muscles. After 10 minutes of persevering, Dodd's left leg began to wobble and seize up. It had already been cramping horribly and now was reaching its limit. He knew he had to hurry, possibly only one more attempt. If he couldn't get it, he dreaded the alternative of securing the balls to the wall next to him and climbing down to his buddies on the patio below. Ho-whoosh! Dodd gave it everything he had, determined to succeed. Unfortunately, his prior assessments that had kept him throwing cautiously were well grounded. The force of his attempt dislodged the top tool completely and sent him flailing off the wall. For a split second, time stood still. The thoughts that raced through Dodd's mind were diverse. He thought about Buck and Boot below him and wondered whether they would try to catch him. He thought about his conversation with Bamboo in Pap's place and about the unusual circumstances in Green. He thought about Pap telling him to never give up. And finally, he thought about his mother and two little brothers. It was his final thought that left him wishing earnestly. In his heart, he solemnly promised that if he could live to return to Cedar City, he would apologize to his mother for all of the times he hadn't helped her out, and for all of the times he had let her down. She had been just as lonely as he had been, only she had been left to deal with three difficult sons as well, one of whom had become substantially more troublesome since Pap's passing, as though it were her fault. Apparently, the dimming light of death brought a brightening recollection of life. Everything seemed so much clearer. If he could just live, he would live differently, more unselfishly, especially with his family at home. Dodd didn't expect to escape harm, yet he still hoped somehow Boot and Buck would soften his fall before he landed on the cold stone floor. Grink! The rope cinched tightly around Dodd's left hand and squeezed all of the blood out of his fingers. The balls on the PulsarFlex had landed squarely against the wall, inches from the top, and had instantly attached to the stone, leaving Dodd dangling at the end of a tight line. It was miraculous. Within moments, Dodd was climbing for his life, glad to see safety within reach. His left hand and shoulder ached, but the rush of survival numbed the pain. Once on the roof, Dodd turned to look down. Boot and Buck weren't visible in the darkness. "Did you make it?" Boot asked. His voice carried softly up the wall to Dodd. "I'm safe. I'll be fine. Meet you back at our room," responded Dodd in a hushed voice. That was all he said before continuing on his journey. The roof was covered with vines, bushes, and small trees. and because there was no direct access to it from inside the castle, it was completely overgrown, without any trails or walkways. Its purpose was to look beautiful from the distance, as well as to provide protected nesting grounds for some rare varieties of birds that lived around Lake Modge. As Dodd fought through the undergrowth, birds flew in every direction. It was as if there were more creatures than plants. Each step brought more startling movements. To calm his nerves, Dodd whistled, hoping some of the birds would launch before he bumped them to flight. Gradually, light began to cut through the thicket. It was the moon rising across the horizon. Its dim rays appeared bright, revealing how black things had been in the grove and making everything visible. The garden was much bigger than it looked from the ground. It spanned at least 15 acres and wrapped completely around a windowless 20-foot stone structure. Dodd could see part of Pap's place on top of the building, surrounded by another level of gardens. "That's some penthouse," said Dodd to himself, making his way to a relatively vine-free part of the wall. Within a few minutes, Dodd had secured his pulsar flex and scaled the barrier. On top, the gardens were drastically different than the larger sprawl below. They were orderly, with walkways, and had many different varieties of bushes and flowers and trees. One path led down a stairway to a locked enclosure. It was a giant cage filled with shrubs and grass. Bars tightly crisscrossed the roof. In the center of the highest gardens was Pap's place. It looked like an elegant home sitting in the middle of a well-planned estate. If someone had blindfolded Dodd and taken him to the spot where he stood, he would have never guessed that he was on top of a monstrous castle. Unless he was allowed to walk to the edge of the lower gardens, where tapering levels below would have given him a hint of the circumstance. However, even at that, he would have presumed that the floors below were multiple dwellings, tapering down a hillside, not the levels of one unbelievably large structure. It was mind-boggling to think of anyone designing and building Bombu's castle. "I'm home," said Dodd to himself, hurrying along a path that led to the house. He was trying to build up enough courage to enter. Thoughts of his last visit to Pap's place flooded his mind, but he pushed them out, whispering to himself, "Nobody's in there. I'm all alone." A clanking sound stopped Dodd dead in his tracks, about 20 feet out. It was familiar. He had heard it the last time he visited Pap's place. It made chills roll down his spine and across his arms. His eyes searched for an enemy while his hands reached for the knife he had secured in a large pocket on the back of his shirt. The knife was gone, and so were the two Buster candles he had brought. They had all fallen out when he had struggled during his climb up the first wall. Pap's door inched open. Dodd froze. Someone or something was coming out of Pap's place. But before anything emerged, the door swung closed, producing a familiar clank. During the prior invasion, the door had been damaged, so the slightest breeze swayed the door open and closed, creating a horrifyingly scary clank. It was the most relieving discovery Dodd had ever made. Once inside, Pap's house was dimly lit by moonlight, as it had been before. Dodd tiptoed down a cluttered hall that led him straight to a recognizable spot, the entrance to Pap's office. He slid inside and walked across the dark room until a pile of swords clattered under his feet. "Now, where did I leave that candle?" muttered Dodd. He bent down and began to carefully feel around for the one he had left during his abrupt exit. "I've got it," he said triumphantly, as his hands found the precious light. The Buster candle was easy to ignite. All it required was a decent strike against something solid, and with Pap's sword collection littering the floor, he had the candle lit as soon as he found it. Shortly thereafter, Dodd selected a sword from the pile. He felt like he was probably the only one in Pap's house at the time, yet the pounding of his heart insisted he take proper precautions. Next, he emerged from the office and made his way down the familiar hall, through the entry room, and to the front door. If Buck and Boot had accompanied him, he would have lingered, but without them, the lure of interesting objects was diminished. Dodd exited Pap's house and entered the long corridor to the shaft. It reminded him that all of the rappelling equipment was at the bottom, waiting for a ride up. He turned around and tried to re-enter to search for a spare harness. However, the door was locked. Without hesitation, Dodd began exploring the hall and pleasantly found there were items hung on the walls, offering a selection of parts to choose from in manufacturing his own rappelling gear. It was a much different experience than the time before, where he had been forced to scurry in the dark while escaping. There were a couple of coats, shovels, wooden poles, buckets, brooms, and coils of twine. Below the coats, Dodd found something else, a 6-inch metal hook. He almost skewered himself on it accidentally, and he wasn't the only one that had missed seeing it. The hook was covered in long, silky black hair, the likes of which he had never seen before, and while he looked closer, he found dried blood on the hair. It chilled his blood to see it. Possibly the hair was from the dreadful creature that had followed him during his last escape. He couldn't be sure, but thinking about it made him hurry in selecting an old coat to aid his descent. Also, using a strip of twine, Dodd lashed the candle to the end of his sword and then tied a loop of twine to the other end, making it possible to wear it around his neck like a sling. "I'm keeping the lights on," said Dodd proudly, as he slid down the rope, using the coat for friction. At the bottom, finishing his task was almost too easy. Before his feet had even touched the ground, candlelight reflected off Pap's keys. They were dangling from his broken necklace that was caught on the side of a large wooden basket. One of the edges protruded like a finger, holding the chain hostage. Relief washed over Dodd. The keys hadn't been taken by anyone, and he had successfully recovered them. Dodd tucked the priceless treasures into his pocket and grabbed for the door when memories of Jib confronting him flooded his mind. They were enough to persuade him into hiding the swords behind a pile of blankets before leaving the shaft. After all, the Drat Patrol was guarding Rawl Hall 24/7 following the skunking, and though he didn't plan on being caught by them, he knew their suspicions would be much worse if he were carrying a sword. When Dodd emerged, Boot, Buck, Sonny, and Dilly were standing at the entrance to Green Hall, waiting for him, busily talking and laughing. Their commotion made it easy to join them without being noticed by guards, which was very lucky. With Zerny and Jib gone, the flow of drats walking the halls was almost constant. They had been told something that left them on high alert, and they intended to do their job, detaining anyone who looked remotely suspicious. And by morning, it was clear their worries were not without merit.